What a historian, huh? Scott Allen Roberts with us. His work's, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's got several websites. They're there for you, so go take a look. We're going to come back, though, and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Scott Allen Roberts with us, of course, and we're talking about his works, and there are many. Scott, which was your favorite? Did you have a favorite of all the books you wrote?
Yeah, I would have to say The Exodus Reality was the favorite because it involved all this travel to Egypt and really getting your feet in the sand, so to speak, and seeing things up close. And I would say my least favorite, which you didn't ask me, but I'll tell you, was probably The Reptilians, because it was a book that was outside the realm of what I was used to writing about, and I really had to dig on that. And because I'm not one of those that tends to believe in some of these things too deeply without the proof. I've become very pragmatic in my old age, and it's something where I got to see it, touch it, taste it, handle it, talk to it, in order for it to mean something to me and to become something, which sounds awfully funny for a guy that was in seminary at one point.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'll tell you that The Exodus Reality was my favorite because it was tangible to me. It was dealing with a topic that people question, and there's controversy over whether or not it really happened, but at the same time, it was tangible. I could be there, and, you know, I believe the man existed. Moses existed. I believe I know who he was. And so when I would visit places there, tangible things were there to touch and say he would had to have crossed this very threshold I'm standing on in this temple. He would have had to have been here. He would have had to have done this. And I don't know if there's time for it, and you can cue me in if you want me to talk about it at all, but there are experiences that happened to me there.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. And also, I have to ask you about Moses parting the Red Sea.
It's not my original theory, of course, but remember in the passage it says, And Moses stretched the rod over the waters, and a strong east wind blew all night and parted the waters. And it was as if they were on dry ground. Excuse me. Now, of course, you have to go back just a little bit further to say, where did if the Israelites did dwell in Egypt, where did they live, and where did they come from, and what path did they take, and where were they on the Red Sea? Was it the great wide expanse of the Red Sea? I don't think so. There was a capital in the north in Memphis. It was Menifer. Today it's known as Memphis. It's right at the mouth of the Nile Delta, about 30 miles south of present-day Cairo. The land of Goshen that the Israelites would have lived in was off to the east of this area in the Nile Delta area. And there is the Wadi Tumulat. It's this waterway. It's dry most of the year, but you can follow it from the land of Goshen area, the East Delta region, over to you can see it on maps. You go to Google Earth, you can see it. There's this little arc of green fertile that curves all the way over to the northern lakes, the Bitter Lakes, they're called, the Sea of Reeds, which is all in the north of the Red Sea, after the north tip of the Red Sea. And these shallow lakes are there. And there is a phenomenon. Now, this is just one of the explanations, but I think it was one of the most plausible to me. There is a geologic natural event that occurs very rarely, but it occurs where the strong winds come off the Negev, off the south of Israel and across the north tip of the Sinai and into that region north of the Red Sea. And it has the capability, with these strong winds, of shallowing the waters. It pushes the waters away and dries off the shallow regions in the lake. And it leaves a place for people to cross, quote-unquote, on dry ground. And those waters can rush back in pretty quick. Even though the lakes are not as deep as the sea, it can rush back in pretty quick, and you better not be in the way when it happens. So this is one of the plausible explanations. Now, this is not to detract from true believers. This is not to say there was not the, if you will, the magical hand of God involved in this. It is to say that what's a miracle? Sometimes a miracle is the unnatural happening in a natural place and in a natural event. So I think that some of these things happened, but maybe not in the most cinematic Cecil B. DeMille ways that we think they did.
So of all these things that you have done and you've investigated, Has anything scared you?
Yeah. I like to say nowadays, and I hope I don't say this with too much bravado, that I don't get scared. I can get startled. I can get taken off my guard and so on, but there's nothing that really scares me. And I say that with a bit of trepidation. I scare myself when I say that, because who knows what's out there waiting that I'm going to run into. It's going to scare the
pants
off.
Where evil lurks, huh?
Where evil lurks, yeah. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men. And there are things that have happened to me that they only scare me in the sense that I don't understand them fully. I can define them by the way people write about things or talk about things. You can come up with a definition for things that happen. But there are unsettling things that have happened to me. And one of them just involves, when I was in Egypt, I had an experience there. I had a couple of them that I wanted to talk to you about, but one very brief. I was told by a psychic friend of mine, who I trust very much, a man named Chris Conway. He was on the, for a couple of seasons, he was on the Brit show Most Haunted as the medium, and replacing the Derek Acora medium. But he and I were there, and he said, you have attached to you an Egyptian man from ancient times who, and there's a lot of detail this that I'll skip, but he says that this man says he's attached to you. He won't give me his name yet when he first introduced me to him. And he said he will be with you whenever you are in Egypt, but he'll never leave Egypt. And that he is attached to you because he thinks, you think the way he thinks. And some of this stuff played out. That, to me, that's a little spooky. I don't have visions. I'm not given to flights of fancy. Believing in skeptics, I'm skeptical of, and I believe in psychics about 1 in 100, if you will. It all depends on the credibility I think the person has and so on. And, you know, George, when I was there, there were things that gripped me. And I had to step back at times and say, is it my emotion about being here, about studying the things I'm studying? Is that overtaking me? Is it a psychological thing? Or is there really a viable spirit world? It was Manetho in the 4th century BC, an Egyptian historian again, who called Egypt the land of the dead. I'm sorry, the land of the gods, the demigods, and the land of the dead, something like that. And this is what you get when you get there. There is so much history and so much that has happened there that you step into places and it's palpable. And you want to put on this thinking cap when you go in there and you start to feel, I get chills up my back and my arms right now, so the hair standing on my arms, thinking about some of these things and saying, did I put on my thinking cap when I went in? Did I, not to shut anything out, but to make sure I wasn't emotively creating something in my own mind. And these things that happened to me were not things that, they were things that I might hear somebody else's story like this.
Right,
and
not believe it. That's
but
right.
Because it happened to me.
Let's take some calls for sure. They're lining up. Dennis in Alberta, Canada. Take it away, Dennis.
Hey, George, long-time listener. Can't believe I got through.
Well, I'm glad you did. Go ahead.
I was just curious of your guest's thoughts on this new technology that's allowing us to observe gravity waves for the first time and the implications it might have on lacking the I guess you would say, the mechanism how gravity interacts with our universe. And I just wondered, is it possible to explain, I've recently heard that gravity isn't actually a force pulling us towards the planet, as everyone kind of seems to think, that it's more of an act of the planet displacing space, and it's actually space pushing against the planet. I wondered if your guests could go into that.
Well, I got to tell you, first of all, I'm not a gravitational scientist. I don't study these things, but I have seen some of the information that you're talking about. And I look at that and I go, that's science. And I like it, and I like to read about it, but I don't spend lots of time there with this kind of thing, especially on the gravity. But I have seen that, and to me, I would say if science is starting to prove that there is force that's pushing away and keeping us on the ground, that's great. It still works for me either way. So I don't mean to be so flippant about it, but it's not something I've studied. It's not something that I've spent a lot of time with. But I look at that, and I know that they've been able to see gravitational wave now. They're developing equipment that can do that. I've even seen it being used or at least mentioned in paranormal circles, as this is something that could be used as tools to gauge what is there and what is happening. So that's as far as I know on any of that information, other than, to me, it's science. It's like knowing that my heart beats blood. That's great. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to study that anymore.
So, we need to get you a degree in physics, Scotty.
There you go.
Brian in Virginia, east of the Rockies. Hey, Brian, go ahead.
Yes, George. Nice to speak to you. First time caller.
Oh, good. Good to have you with us.
I would like to ask your guest there. He calls us, did he say he had a degree in theology?
He's a theologian indeed. Did you have a degree in theology, Scotty?
I have no degree, and I wrote about this in my first book on the Nephilim because I got a lot of criticism. People say, you call yourself a historian, but you don't have a historical degree. And I said, well, I study history. I said, so I guess I have to put the word rogue or you know, flippant or something like that in front of the word historian.
No problem at all.
What's that?
That's no problem at all. I can totally understand that. Have you actually read the Bible then?
Yes, I
have. I'm wondering because you misquoted yourself a couple of times. For one thing, Elohim does not mean, by no way, God, the original name of God. Now, in Paleo Hebrew, El was the name of God. Elohim is a place modifier. It means that it is extra-dimensional, because if it wasn't, then when the Witch of Endor, Saul had the Witch of Endor call Samuel up.
See, I think everybody thinks, though, Elohim means God.
Don't
you think, Scott?
Not to part ways with you there, caller, for the sake of parting ways, but Elohim was one of the names attributed to God in the old. I've seen many people come up with many different reasons why they think Elohim means something else. In Paleo Hebrew, if you will, the word El was a word that came from, etymologically, it came from Enlil and Elil in the Mesopotamian culture. And the name El, as it traveled down with humans into the Canaanite region, the Canaanites picked up El from Elil. El became the name, the word for God. Him in the Hebrew is, as I mentioned earlier, a plural suffix that's tacked on the name. Elohim means God of or God among many gods by definition. Unless you look at it and try to change it into, well, maybe that just means it's a God, one God, a singular God with multiple majesty and power. So there are different ways to define the word, but when you define the word, when you look at words in context, you have to look at them as to how it relates to everything else written in that text. And you can't say one part of the text is this kind of Hebrew and the other part of the text is that kind of Hebrew. It's usually defined by the context itself. And interestingly enough, where El became Elohim, or Elil became Elohim from the Mesopotamian Anunnaki down to the 1,500 years later Canaanite culture, the name Enki, who we're all familiar with from the Anunnaki, Enki, one of the brother gods, whose name was also Ea, that was his second name, Ea, and spelled E-A. And in that same transmission of religion and cultural move from the Euphrates River Valley down into the Canaanite culture, where El became Elohim, Ea became the base word for Yahweh, which is, of course, translates into Jehovah. And so you have these two gods, and I was just, by the way, reading something today, George, that talks about these scholars have long wondered and argued about the theological and hermeneutical trajectories that allowed committed monotheists in Jewish religion to accept that there was a new God in Jesus Christ, in the Christologies and so on. And that is because you had these multiple gods in the Old Testament. If you look at the Garden of Eden, you had Elohim, who was the one that would say, the humans have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and have become just like gods. Let us, plurality, therefore go down and prevent them from eating also the tree of life, lest they become just like us, plurality. And that's Elohim. But then there was the kinsman redeemer, the one that was prophesied from the beginning, the one that would become the Messiah, the Christ, and in Greek. And that was Jehovah. That was from the name Yah, which became Yahweh. And so there are multiple meanings, but I believe, and this is where I ran into some trouble with some people at times, is that I'm going to step out on this branch, George. I believe the Bible doesn't, in its core and its encoded message, isn't strictly monotheistic. It teaches that there are other gods. Psalm 82 talks about, in the English, and God stood in the midst of the gods, the divine council. And when you read it in the Hebrew, it's an Elohim, singular, stood in the midst of the Elohim, plural. And he, singular, said to them, plural, you are all Elohim, plural, the bright shining princes of heaven, which ties into Nakosh in the Garden of Eden, the snake character, the serpent character, who was, I believe, one of the Elohim. So here's what you start to get into when you start to look at all this stuff. And you got to take ancient writing, you got to look at it in the context of when it was written, to whom it was written, what their understanding would have been of what was written.
It can be misinterpreted, though, can it?
The name?
The ancient writings.
I think you can misinterpret meaning. You can't misinterpret text. All you can say is the text says this. Then sometimes you're left scrambling and scratching your chin whiskers and going, what does that mean? So, which I do an awful lot of.
Yeah, let's let you quickly give out a few of your websites to people who want to just jot them down.
Sure. If you ever want to see my stuff or get a hold of me, just my full name, Scott Allen Roberts, and that's Allen is A-L-A-N because there's like 20 ways to spell Allen. So ScottAllenRoberts.com, that's my main site. And you can go to IntrepidMag.com, that's the magazine site. And everything else is linked up to all of that.
So where did the
Facebook and all that?
Where did the 12 tribes of Israel go?
Oh boy, you're talking about the diaspora.
Did they scatter?
The scattered Jews. Yeah, I believe after they started migrating, I believe, from Israel into other surrounding cultures, and they became the diaspora. Now This immediately brings to mind, so I think it's worth mentioning, my grandfather, who was my mother's stepfather. I'm of Welsh Scottish stock.
Okay.
But my grandfather, my mom's stepdad, was a Jewish man, Hungarian Jew. And he wasn't Orthodox by any means. He's more agnostic than anything else. But he reminds me of the diaspora. Where are the Jews today? Were they just people who picked up and believed, or were they family lines? This is something very intrinsic.
Well, I don't think they just disappeared, Scotty. That's for sure. We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Our final segment with Scott Allen Roberts as we talk about his latest works. One, The Exodus Reality, Unearthing the Real History of Moses, Identifying the Pharaohs and Examining the Exodus from Egypt. How long did Moses live, Scott?
Well, according to the Bible story, he lived 120 years old. In Egypt, I know in their religious practice, 110 was considered to be the perfect age. So he lived beyond that. Now, if he literally lived that, when you go to doing the dating and so on, you can come up with dates that fit that age. Now, the big question, of course, always is there efficacy to the biblical story? And that's what you have to decide. And sometimes you accept that as much by faith as you do the fact that God performed a miracle of splitting the water. There's a lot of conjecture and a lot of speculation, but hopefully the way it comes across in our book is that the speculation, the conjecture, are arrived at very academically.
Before, you know, when you were talking about the reptilians, and you said it's not Lucifer, it was not the devil, do you believe, however, that creature called the devil, Satan, does exist?
I believe that there is probably an entity that exists that is Satan or Satan-like that it's based upon. I found it very interesting. The oldest chronological book written in the Old Testament is the book of Job. And we all know from, you know, the saying, the patience of Job, the endurance of Job, and so on. It has a story at the beginning that sounds very much like a tale of Greek tragic encounter with the gods or gods toying with people's lives. It says, it reads, the Satan entered the courts of heaven. It had the article in front of the name, the Satan, almost like it was a title. The Satan entered the courts of heaven and accused Job before God, and God said, yeah, go ahead, strike him down. I'll bet you he'll still be faithful to me. And it was almost like this toying with people's lives that were taught a very different lesson when you're in church. But the Satan, he was that a title? Does that mean other people held the title? Other beings held the title? I don't know for sure. But I do find that Satan, as he has become to be known, if you trail back and study who he was and the origins and in the biblical texts, I do believe he was one of the Elohim. He was one of this divine council. And I think you go to Psalm 82. Folks, read Psalm 82, and you'll get an idea of what's going on there.
Okay, back to the rest of the calls that we have. We go to Don in Riverdale, New York. Good morning, Don.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm good. I hope you are, too.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to ask your guest, what is the religious significance or Bible significance of Enoch, and what can he tell me about Enoch?
Oh, Enoch's very interesting. I know that there's the book written by Enoch, which is one of the apocryphal books. It was booted out. You know, it's wrong to say it was just the Council of Nicaea, but it all began with the Council of Nicaea in the 320s when Constantine wanted to coalesce his empire. He wanted to prove or set forward the thought that in everybody's mind, there's one God equals one emperor, one religion equals one empire. And this is what he set out to do with these councils. I think he was about as Christian as my little toe. but he started the process of eliminating books, had these bishops through several different councils, eliminating certain books from the Bible. The ones they could not have, he said, I don't care which ones you choose, you just better be unanimous on it. And whatever you're not unanimous on, it gets kicked out. And Enoch was one of those books. I always say, rather tongue-in-cheek, that the Book of Enoch is like reading the Lord of the Rings on crack with religious overtones, and because there's some wild stuff in that book. But Enoch was a guy, and I think he was like the great-grandson of Adam or something like that. And, of course, in the biblical accounts, everybody lived hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, so many generations had gone by, but he was like the third from Adam, or I think something like that, or the ninth from Adam, I can't remember off the top of my head, but he wrote this encounter. And we were taught about Enoch in Sunday school when I was a kid. There's that wonderful sounding verse in the King James Bible that says, and Enoch walked with God and was not, for God took him. And so we don't know what that really means, but it says that he is one of the two people in the Bible that is mentioned to never have experienced death. And so he wrote this book, and it was supposed to be in the days of Enoch was when the Elohim descended to the earth, the sons of the Elohim, and impregnated human women and bequeathed the Nephilim. And that's when it all happened. So there's lots of chapters in the Book of Enoch that talk about that event.
Tim's in Oklahoma. Welcome to the show, Tim. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, George. Thanks for taking my call. And Scott, I just had two questions and wanted to get your thoughts on. If you thought that Antichrist had to be a man, could it be a woman, or could it be a representation of a woman? If you know Revelation 18...
Are you asking me if it's Hillary?
Scott. Well, it could be Hillary or...
Sorry, he said woman. There's a woman running for president. I was just curious to know if that's where he was heading with that.
There's a second part to my question.
Sure.
In chapter 18 of Revelations... It refers to Mystery Babylon and the Great New City, and it keeps referring to her. And knowing that the Statue of Liberty is a representation of America, of justice and whatnot.
So you're drawing the the correlations between those.
Right.
You know, I think it is somewhat dangerous is too powerful a word, but I'll use it because I can't think of a better one. It's a little dangerous when we have current day like statuary and cities and people and stuff, and we try to plug them into biblical prophecies. That's why I just mentioned Hillary. It was meant to be a joke, but this is what people will do. They will try to plug current names into prophecies, and they've been doing it for hundreds of years. So could the Statue of Liberty be the Whore of Babylon and all of that? I personally doubt it, because I think that these were prophecies and visions that they saw. Remember, these guys who wrote this, John who wrote this, these guys all believed this was going to happen in their lifetime.
Yes.
Not 2,000 years
and
later.
And many civilizations have always felt that.
Yes.
In their lifetime.
Right.
And here we are now.
The Apostle Paul, who wrote two-thirds of the New Testament. And I have my questions. You've had a great guest on, Jeff Dougherty, so you know how he thinks about this. But Paul, in his writings, kept telling people the end times are now. They're happening in our lifetime. And that was 2,000 years ago. I don't think they thought they were prophesying 2,000 years ahead. So, you know, it's to me, that means the ball field is wide open.
West of the Rockies, Wayne is with us in Lakewood, Washington now. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Good morning, George and Scotty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Really touching on a lot of the good things that are important. And I remember once somebody said that it's okay to have an open mind just as long as you don't let your brains fall out. So in consideration of that, Solomon, King of England, when he prayed for wisdom. And, of course, because he only prayed for wisdom, God gave him the greatest empire and wealth upon earth. Whole countries went to him, and, of course, he was responsible for putting together all the things that set up for the great temple. And in speaking of the plurality of God, it is, Elohim is a plurality of the one God. We generally call him the Trinity. I like to refer to him as the Triunity. Of course, the Father, the universal spirit that is all over in all universes, in all dimensions. Nothing contains him.
If I can interject a thought there, too.
Sure.
Remember, the Israelites, the Jews, did not have a Trinity in Old Testament times.
Absolutely.
The Trinity came out of the New Testament and beyond. And we've attributed that to certain things that are said in the Old Testament. How could there be a plurality of God speaking in the Garden of Eden? Well, that's obviously the Trinity. Well, we don't know that because the Jews, the Hebrews, the Israelites, however you want to look at them, they did not have a Trinity. They did not recognize a Trinity.
But remember when Abraham met the three on the trail coming into his camp, and they said that his wife was going to have a baby. There were three of them, and that was God the Father making himself available in physical form, the only time in the Bible that that's recorded, God the Son and God the Holy Spirit.
But see, we have attributed that to that story, because in that story, in the text, it doesn't say that. But we have said that. We have put that on much later and said, well, that's obviously the Trinity it's talking about. No, the passage says it was three men, and it was indicating there was three angels that were delivering this message.
And back to Revelation for a second, Scott. Is it a great story, or is it truly a prediction of the future?
I think it's a great story, like the writings of Nostradamus are a great story, if you will, even though it's not a narrative. So that almost indicates immediately that I'm a non-believer. I'm not a non-believer. I've become a confirmed agnostic. In you know, the more I think through things, meaning simply, I don't know for sure, if you can boil it down to a vernacular. So I think Revelation is a very interesting story. It's very complicated when you look at it. There's no easy way in and throughout Revelation to interpret it. What are the seven signs? What are the seven seals? What are the seven ten dragon heads? What are this? What is that? These are all the visions of a man in his 90s. Who said these were visions given to him by God. And it's like I like to say about Moses. He said he saw God in a burning bush, but he was the only guy there, and he wrote about it. So we take him at his word by faith.
What do you think of prophecy? Do you think there's some foundation to it?
I do. I think that there is foundation to prophecy, and I can't tell you why I believe that is so. I accept that that's so because I have seen things from people that are predictive. I have seen psychic activity, mediumship. I kind of put them all in the same boat. Prophecy's got that more, tends to have that more religious overtone to it. But, yeah, I think that there are people out there who have that ability. I think that there are people who are touched in that way or are in connection with something, be it God, be it angels, be it demons. Keep in mind, in Egypt, they called on the demons of the Tuat, which were demons they were kind of neutral in those contexts in Egypt, and they would call on these beings. And so, prophecy, yeah. I believe it's real. I believe it happens. I would like to see prophecy fulfilled. Prophecy fulfilled is something that confirms my faith more than believing that prophecy delivered may happen someday. So I like to see it coming to pass.
What did you think of the visions of George Washington when he saw a decimated United States?
That was very interesting. And you've got to ask yourself, did he have a vision? Was that a dream? Was it really a vision? Did an angel appear to him, like he said, out in the woods? These are all questions that we don't really know for sure. When all of this mystical stuff happens, George, and this is what it falls into my belief about the whole reptilian thing, about God, about everything else, is we weren't there and we don't know. All we have is accounts. I can give you an account of a story I had in Egypt, and people could listen to that and say, oh, that's a great story, but we weren't there. You were the only one there, and that's your story. And so I don't know for sure, but I think it's fascinating that George Washington, the man that we look to as the father of our country, is a man who also had visions of the destruction of the country.
Let's go to Dan in Lafayette, Indiana. First-time caller. Dan, we got you in. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, George. Very good, Scotty. Excellent points you're making. I have some information I think that will greatly fill some holes and give you some insight. The main thing is the serpent seed doctrine.
Right.
That's very good. You know about that. The dual seed line of the real story of Cain.
I've had people relate that to me saying, when you purport anything that sounds like that, Scotty, you're really talking Christian identity, which is basis, you know, founded in theosophism and Nazism and occult and things like that. And I say, well, no, I'm talking about a different thing. So, but the serpent seed doctrine, yeah, the divided seed between Cain and Abel, kids of Eve and Adam and Eve and Nakash.
Eve was beguiled in the Garden of Eden. That means seduced spiritually and sexually. She had twins. Cain and Abel were twins. One was Satan's son, one was Adam's son. And Jesus talked about this, and the whole lineage of Jesus Christ came through Seth. And before Jesus was put to death, he said to the Jewish people there, you are like your father, a liar and murderer from the beginning.
Well, this is what I find very interesting about that whole lineage, is that you've got right there in the story in the Garden of Eden, you've got Eve, who, if you look at other first families and other religious cultures, they all had multiple births, you know, twins, triplets, quintuplets even. Eve bore two sons, and it says that she was beguiled by the serpent character and that she took it to Adam as well, And right there in the garden, there's what is considered by most schools, even rabbinic schools, to be the first prophecy of the coming Messiah, the kinsman redeemer. And it's where God says to the serpent and to the woman and the man, and he says, there will be enmity between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, or of the humans. And he says, but there will be a day, and he goes in to deliver what's considered to be the first prophecy of the Messiah. And all through the Old Testament, you see in the genealogies, they always trace the lineage of the humans back through Seth, the third born to Adam. Why did they go to Seth? I believe it's, well, first of all, Abel's gone. He was the second born as a twin. And the firstborn was Cain. Why aren't they taking the lineage through Cain? Well, I believe it's because the Bible is very clear that Cain was the son of Nakash. He was not the son of Adam. And when the Bible keeps talking about there is this kinsman redeemer, the one who will be one of us redeemer, there's meaning to that.
There sure is. Scotty, thanks for being on the program. Great work. We'll have you back again. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Montessor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp. I'm George Norrie somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.